bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting. Hello, welcome to the Photo Show. It's Friday, the weekend starts here. I'm Ewan Rankin. Carl is not back for a third week running. We're going to smack his bottom when we see him at the bash, that's for sure. But the good news is that the mead's arrived today. I have 18 pints of mead in there, in the room, and there'll be 17 when you lot come for the bash.
Glad I'm a medic.
I did. We may try it. We may try a little bit this evening, but it's a huge, big, white cardboard thing, and it's heavy. But I'll keep it in the shade. Don't worry, it'll be fine. Joining me this week to discuss the photo news and answer your questions is the usual motley crew. Back from his extended absence, first of all, Mr. Forsman. How you doing, mate?
Hello.
Looking like he's in a lounge in the middle of Beirut, waiting for the shelling to start.
Oh, he was in Bora Bora.
How you doing, pal?
Better. I've just emerged from 4 straight days of reviewing the new Retina MacBook Pro.
Ugh.
So I have no idea what happened in the world. None.
That's pretty damn cool. Did you like it?
I do. I've got to tell you, the screen is amazing.
Yeah.
And just every single photo looks awesome on it because you're seeing it, you know, at a resolution, you know, it's not quite what you would see on a print, but it's so close. And so you really see, I mean, you can even look at icons and tell if a photo's in focus or not.
Yeah, it's crazy. That's,
you that's say that good. Like it's a positive thing.
Maybe you don't want to know. I don't know.
joining us also, Mr. Alex G. Fox.
Famous for his fuzzy photos. How are you, Ewan?
There's nothing wrong with fuzzy photos, mate.
No, I've made a career out of it. It's called artistic.
You and me both. Week been good?
You know what? I can categorically say, yeah, it's been all right.
It's been all right.
Yeah, it's been all right.
Have you bought yourself a brand new Retina MacBook Pro?
No.
No.
It's not a new camera after all, is it?
No, I'm not overly impressed with it, to be honest. I think it's a piece of crap.
No, I'm waiting for a nice Retina iMac, and then I'll blow everything I haven't got on that.
The week in photography news. It's not been a huge week, it has to say. But there's an interesting story to start us off with. A new patent for Panasonic has revealed that there's an opportunity for a sensor which can capture multiple images at once.
Hmm.
Which sounds rather good. Multiple exposures in one shot. The patent seems to show a sensor which can adjust the exposure of every row of pixels depending on what the camera is pointing at. That could potentially mean that when shooting something with mixed lighting conditions, the exposure time could be different for different parts of the scene. Any thoughts initially? Sounds interesting, but...
It sounds more, yes, for photography it sounds great, but for video, I mean, bearing in mind what they're saying is rows, so at the moment you wouldn't be able to necessarily expose different segments of the screen as such, but, you know, once they've got this right, I'm sure they can get the rest of it right. If you think about it like crosshair focusing, if you think about it in that way and you could have 100 different zones on the screen, for instance, but for video, something like that, that would be revolutionary.
Is the question then, though, really going to be more about the controllability of where you're shooting and what you're changing? Is that where we're going to have to get into like a touchscreen mode where you can highlight areas that you want to change exposures for and then it'll naturally dither and blend that? Information that you can then extract?
Yeah, well, I think if you're going to do it that way, I would suggest that you've probably got the ability to do that with software now anyway. But if you want to do something point and shoot plus, so that's what I mean by videoing, because to re-expose video is so much more difficult than to do stills. If you could do something where the camera had an auto function on it, I think that's where the usability is, isn't it? Because for normally, if you've got a picture now, unless the extremes are, you know, so far out you can't even use a filter on them, you can recover that. But you can't necessarily do it very easily with film. So I'd suggest that it's more of an automatic process, which would help a lot of people on maybe the lower end or the more consumer market. That's where I'd go with it.
Any thoughts, Chris?
I kind of have to agree, though. I wonder, like, exactly how the benefit will apply. You know, because again, if you're scanning line by line, it seems like it's only going to work like in situations like, say, the sky is really bright, and then you move down the image, and then you have a horizon with some kind of foreground of some type. It's obviously going to be darker in a lot of cases. I agree that the idea is clever, and I agree that I think that the technology will be more useful, once you can sort of adjust exposure for individual areas of the image. But it's difficult to really predict how a technology like that would even work. I mean, you have all these really complex, like even Nikon's 3D color matrix RGB, 1,000 pixel whatever meter. I mean, you've got a lot of information there, but how best to use it and to be dynamically adjusting exposure while you're taking pictures. It's a complex problem, I think, and I'm not sure if this solution. I have a hard time seeing how this particular solution will be much benefit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sitting thinking, the alteration of exposure for stills is bad enough, or can be bad enough if you're looking to capture things quickly. Mm-hmm. Real-time capture to this kind of degree with change and alteration. From an ergonomics viewpoint, I guess it's got to be captured in some kind of metadata that then allows you to change it a la RAW.
Mm. Yeah, but I like the idea of being able to make sure you never clip the highlight values or you never go too low on the low values. So you've always got every part of your image is within a range that can be recoverable with a RAW file. The trouble with a lot of the things that this could help is if you expose for the darker areas, you will burn out the lights. There's nothing you can do because of the image you're trying to shoot. And conversely, if you expose for the highlight values, you're going to get the blacks too black. So even the shadow and highlight function won't save you. But if this can, even if it just brings down the values in the sensor itself, so the information is there, so you haven't clipped it. So in reality, you've got the ability to adjust the lowest and the highest values because it will not let either of them be over the top. Then that is a very, very useful function, even if it doesn't do anything else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's pseudo compression then, though, at that point, isn't it?
Mm. Well, not necessarily.
It's sort of like dynamic range compression.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, with dynamic range compression, it's still affecting the middle of the picture. With this, all I'm saying is if you get a value of 2.5 over 250 rather than 2.55 for, say, a white, it will underexpose that ever so slightly. And the same with the blacks. It won't let anything go down to zero. It will keep everything above 10. So therefore, you've got the ability to move within those criteria. If you don't do that, you've burnt it out or it's too black and the image is what it is.
But my thought process of what you've just said there, though, is if you're limiting your dynamic range to a bracketed system, then what you're going to end up with is effectively underexposed video or underexposed still. Because the compression won't give you the full range that you would, the tonal range that you'd expect across the image that the eye would see as natural.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, but I'm saying with dynamic range compression, you actually compress everything. I'm only talking about the very end, but not compressing it as such, just exposing it to bring that back into, for instance, if you use your eyes to look at the scene, your eye would re-expose for the light or the dark, depending on what you were looking at, and that's the natural way to see it. We never actually, as human beings, when we look at something, we never actually see the higher values if we're looking at the low values and vice versa. I mean, you're talking about reality of seeing things. The reality of looking in the sun is you can't see anything else around you. Mm. So a lot of the pictures we take with these issues are issues that wouldn't exist in reality because we wouldn't be able to do both things at once, which a camera can do. So what I'm saying is you just stop it clipping on the top end or the bottom end, and then you've given yourself the ability to work. The middle parameters stay the same, and you're giving yourself the ability to just bring the two things so they are seeable in an image.
Interesting thought here then. So, you know, we've talked about HDR changes, and there's a lot of newspapers now are saying that Reportage, if they do an HDR change to an image, they will specify it at the bottom. I mean, this is natural capture, but it's still alteration of exposed color value and tonal value. So does that still need your disclaimer at the bottom?
Well, I don't know, because in the old days, you'd dodge and burn it to make sure it, you know, you didn't have
Mate, you and I have had this conversation in the past, no end, that there are, you know, alteration of images was, you know, the first time that Ilford sat at the bottom of his stairs and took a picture of the window, he frigging cropped it. You know he did.
Yeah, of course he did. But yes, I'm saying, but what this is doing, and we're going back to the very first point I made, is this is bringing it into a more amateur market, whereas we've got the ability to possibly use, you know, a filter or, you know, neutral density or something to save an image. A lot of point and shoots or, you know, non-professional cameras, not even the camera, just the user won't necessarily have the experience to do that. So what I'm saying, this will give that part of the market, you know, a functionality that they wouldn't have had. I mean, this is perfect for the nightclub shot as well. Because of you've got the bright lights, which are going to burn out, and you've got the person sitting in the background, which you're not going to see, or the other way around. And with something like this, you could overexpose the dark person, so the grain would be reduced, sort of in a dark, you know, the situation. So you'd also get it'd be like having different ISO values within the same image. And if you could do that, you could, you know, an indoor shot, you know, I'm not saying you wouldn't need flash, but you could recover something from an indoor shot with a sensor like this that you could never do with a normal sensor.
I would have thought, unless you're scanning outside the visible range, though, you're never going to get true iteration of colour and not get low light artifacts and so on at all. That's just not I don't see that as a possibility unless you've got a sensor which is going ultraviolet and infrared to look at correction of the stuff that's affecting it from within that low end side.
Yeah, sure. I mean, granted that it wouldn't be as good as getting a properly exposed picture in the first place. No doubt whatsoever.
Thank God. So we're still safe in our profession. Light will still apply in photography.
Only for another few weeks. We're going to be taking pictures by Braille before long.
Any last thoughts, Chris?
No.
No.
I think we covered it.
Done.
That was almost technical.
Asda, that camera shop, says that Asda in the UK's Walmart, they're owned by Walmart, says that its sales of cameras are affected by Instagram. A spokesman for the supermarket said that Asda sells a range of cameras across different categories, and Tech Radar has reported that they're seeing that there's additional benefits from the camera buyer getting these things, and the Instagram effect has caused problems. Has Instagram really changed anything in photography? Is it? I mean, it's.
I don't think it's changed anything in photography. I think what it has done is really taken over where people would have used Instamatic or a Polaroid or a disposable camera or some crappy point and shoot. I mean, you know, we've talked about this issue a lot. The fact is most smartphone cameras are good enough for people's casual snapshots. And that's effectively what it is.
Oh, iPhone 4 is day out camera for me.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
No question.
I think there's an issue with, I think people that, would, you know, which should we say, people that are more into photography than just somebody wants to take a quick picture probably wouldn't go to Asda to buy a camera.
So yeah, I think it's probably fair to say.
Yeah, so I think it's their market, the camera technology, that may be affected. I don't think someone like Calumet or one of I can't think who I use in New York, that wonderful camera.
B&H.
No, but I remember in a minute. It starts with an A, but I'll get it in a minute. I don't think they're
Adorama.
There you go. I don't think they're going to be too affected by, you know, the Instagram effect. But, you know, people that go to Asda to buy a camera probably aren't necessarily going in there to buy one. They're doing the weekly shopping, and they say, well, that's a good price for a camera.
Mm.
And now it's they're going, I don't, Sorry?
It's the £45 camera that's going out of the shopping baskets, yeah.
So, you know, why spend £45 on a camera? Because there's this free app that I've got on my Android phone as well now that makes even my crappiest pictures look less crappy.
Okay.
It's a different
market. That's a whole different debate. But.
Yeah, but it's a different market. That's really my point. If you're going to go to Asda to buy a camera, you're probably, it's not a main part of your existence photography.
While we're talking about taking it out for the family day out, Street Machine, Robert Falk, who's one of our listeners and contributors on the blog, has had a little baby this morning. He hasn't put down what sex it is. Aww. I don't know. But congratulations, Robert. Well done, mate. Street Machine in the chat room on Twitter. I'd like so send to him some thank yous.
I'd like to congratulate his wife. I think she did more than him.
Yes, she did an awful lot. He kept it quiet. We didn't know. He said it's a secret 9-month project. No kidding, dude.
Yeah, not even his wife knew.
Surprise, honey.
Someone has found a patent for an interchangeable iPhone lens. So all of those interchangeable lenses that we've got on the front of iPhones now, including the big Photo Jojo one, which takes full DSLRs, apparently there'll be an opportunity for suing. That sounds horrific. No.
No.
You don't think so?
No. The interchangeable lens patent has to do with removing part of the back panel.
Ah.
And that panel has the lens so that it's perfectly aligned on the optical axis where, you know, they can manufacture it to specific tolerances. And when you're talking about these add-on lenses, you're talking something you stick on with a magnet or a little clip or something. And the whole idea of this patent is actually an improvement on that process. So the patent's perfectly valid, but it has nothing to do with anybody else's interchange. I mean, if somebody would, you know, make something just like this, obviously they'd be in trouble, but...
So we're talking about in iPhone 5 Plus, potentially then, that there's going to be an ability to go for a zoom lens, a wide-angle lens?
I mean, the patent shows that Apple's thinking about it as a possibility, but if you follow the patents that Apple files long enough, you'll realize that maybe... maybe 5 to 10% of them actually make it into products.
Yeah, so if someone comes out with a replaceable back panel that's somewhat deeper that allows that functionality, they've got something to then stop that and the option to do it themselves.
In the old days, I had, I think it was called a disc camera.
Sony disc, mini disc.
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember, I don't really think
Kodak
it had
disc.
I don't think it had a zoom lens as such, but it had a flip round thing that said telephoto. I can't remember if it was 2 or 4 times. And basically, it was like a magnifying glass. But that was sort of internal, and you just, like, flipped. It wasn't a switch as such. You manually pushed it round, but, you know, and it was on the inside. And all that did was a teleconverter, basically. And it sounds like what they're patenting, whatever word we're using this week, what they're doing is that they're having the functionality to do exactly what Kodak did 30 years ago. And that's my reading of it.
Well, interested. So, leading on from that then, we've got Asda saying that their market for cameras is diminishing because of Instagram, and we've got lens patents for going on the back of iPhones, but Jessop's here in the UK, who are a shop, are saying that lens sales are on the up. 34% increase in sale of lenses, according to them, which is actually, that's a third increase is huge, I would have said.
For lenses,
I mean, is this standard DSLR lenses, do you think, the Canon, Nikon, Brigade, or is this Micro Four Thirds really starting to eat into the...
I have a suspicion that some of this Micro Four Thirds...
Yeah.
...that I think, you know, you're getting people who might have opted for a compact camera before... considering the Micro Four Thirds because the size is almost there, and then they're seeing the benefit of having additional lenses or different kinds of lenses, you know, you've different zoom ranges and different apertures and fixed focal lengths and fisheyes and macros, and they're starting to see, you know, the benefit of, you know, oh, this is why these people with these big SLRs always carry around this big bag full of different lenses, you know.
And not at huge prices.
Right.
Yeah. So
I mean, that's I don't have any scientific research to back that up. That's my impression of it.
Well, you're in the right place for that. Right, this is the point. This is where the point where I attempt to blow my own trumpet or hoist my own petard, right?
We haven't got an explicit tag, so do be careful, mate.
Okay, right. Some time ago, I postulated that all this iPhoneography and Androidography, or whatever we want to call it, some of the rebound of that would be people that would have never actually got into photography maybe picking up photography as a hobby because they've finally been introduced to something that they quite like. Now, to me, this might be exactly that. This might be the... Because we were always saying, oh, is the iPhone going to kill cameras? And I said no, because people that use an iPhone wouldn't have necessarily bought a camera before, but people that have used an iPhone or whatever, another generic camera, would maybe get into photography. And also, in a funny way, the Instagram type of thing might be exciting to people. They might say, you know what, this is really good. I can do this with that. What happens if I actually go out and try and do it properly? What happens if I go and buy a lens? They're not expensive. I can buy a lens for £50 to £100 and it will do a lot of things that I would like to learn. I just think that this is the bounce effect that I was talking about. This is people becoming interested because of the camera market on the phone. So that's me attempting to big myself up. It probably is stuff of nonsense, but I'm continuing along that line.
That's fine, mate. You big yourself up as much as you like. You blow that trumpet, Sanjay.
Thank you very much. And that is no one commented, but yeah, thanks.
No, I mean, my first thought when I read that was instantly four thirds and microfill thirds. I think that is exactly where it's gone to, the J1 and N1 or whatever it is. You know, those are the big players, definitely. Lenses, again. I'm learning segues, you see, from Carl. Apparently, last night, his segues were mustard, apparently, on the big show. Sigma have released a brand new lens. It's a super zoom, unquote. I think we're going to have to set a figure on what we call super zoom. And unless it matches that criteria, we feel fully justified in taking the piss out of it mercilessly. Because I don't see 18 to 250 as super zoom myself.
Oh, really?
I want 18 to 500 before I say super.
Oh, no.
That would be ultra zoom. That would be ultra zoom.
No, I'm sorry. 18 to 300.
So can we call it, fellas? Let's set a reasonable bracket. What's the reasonable bracket? Are we saying 18 to 250 is...
No. 18 to 300 is the starting point.
Yeah.
I think you're being unfair. What's 250 on a crop factor? 400. 400, come on.
Well, this is a DC lens, so it's already crop factored.
But that's what I'm saying. This is the equivalent of... A 28 to 400 zoom.
No, it's a DC lens, so it's already factored for the crop, isn't it?
So if you stick a camera, it'd only be an 18 to about 180.
No, well, it wouldn't.
But it's only for crop factor cameras.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I'm saying. If Sigma made an equivalent lens for a 35mm full frame DSLR, it would be a 28 to 400 zoom.
On a crop,
tell me that's not good enough for you.
On a crop factored camera.
28?
Crop camera, yeah. 28.
I laugh in the face of 28.
Lord. Anyway, I swear. Spoilt baby.
So where does the Sigma 50 to 500 fit in, apart from being crap?
The bottom of your bag normally, because you're never going to take it out.
I bought one of those and I sold it and I hated it. The last 1.5 turns were out of focus.
Yeah, first one
and a half
weren't good either.
I'll give Sigma this. I mean, they really do make an effort to come up with some really interesting and unusual lenses or you know, lens ranges that no one else is making. But I think this has been a case for a long time. The quality overall has improved fastly in the last 20 years.
Oh, definitely.
But it's still hit or miss sometimes. Even within the same lens, one sample is not as good as the next one.
Oh yeah, I mean, but if I find with Sigma, there's certain, you know, 18 to 200 is pushing the boundaries really a little bit. But the lenses they make, which are, you know, maybe a fixed lens or, you know, not too great and a 2.8 or something, they're, for the money, they're better than buying a proprietary lens. You know, for for 70% of the price of a Nikon, you're getting more than 70% of the quality. So, right. You know, a lot of them, but they do make some complete dogs as well. And I'm sure I'm going to get some abuse for this, but they do. There's some Sigma lenses I've had before, and I've used them, and I'm almost like, is there something wrong with my camera?
Yeah.
There's something wrong here. I've lost the ability to take a picture.
I think that's perfectly fair, Alex. I mean, I would say that I noticed a step change in Sigma glass about 5 years ago, probably. Five, six years ago. You bought something before that, and it was that you were really taking your money, you know, paying your money and taking your choice. There was
roll the dice, as we say.
Exactly, absolutely. But sort of 4 or 5 years ago, maybe a little bit more, it suddenly decided to produce quality glass, and particularly the low end stuff. You know, the 18-55's got a very, very, very big improvement, and the 12-24. That was a fantastic lens about 4 years ago. Absolutely beautiful. I've broken mine now, but I need to
get it repaired. But there's other companies that have come in to take the, I'm not going to mention anyone, but the market which they left, there's other companies, I dare say it's all manufactured in China or something, they've taken that ground. You can go and buy, I don't know what this, going back to this camera, this lens 18-250, I don't know what this costs because I haven't actually bothered to read it, but you could probably buy something similar for half the price because there are other people in the market that are doing cheap as chips lenses. Oh, look, I can't review a lens that I've no idea. The figures on it look very nice, and I'd imagine if it's a reasonably priced lens, you're going to get what you pay for. But if you want one lens in your kit bag that goes from 18-250 and you don't have a situation where you're going to need anything below 3.5, I would have said, for the value, I'd imagine Sigma do a nice lens.
I mean, I think the one thing that you've got to say with all of these lenses, whether you're talking the 28-300 Tokiner, the 28-300 Tamron, 18-250 Sigma, as this one is, all of these lenses have got the same problem, and that is for pretty much the last 30% of the focal range, they are unusable as images. The last quarter to one third turn of the dial is a pointless exercise, and that's what they've got to address rather than producing more of the same crap. The glass has got better, the quality's improved, granted, fantastic, well done, fellas, but you've got to sort out that last quarter turn. You have to give people the range that you're advertising, because this is an 18-175-180 lens if you're not careful.
Well, that's sort of the thing, isn't it? I mean, you've got companies like Nikon, Canon, and other higher end manufacturers, they could have an 18-200 lens and they could make it go to 400, but the last 200 be useless. But they've got a reputation to uphold that you're paying a premium price, so they can't get away with it. Some of these companies that aren't, you know, I mean, Sigma makes some really nice lenses, but you've got to pay for it. There's certain Sigma lenses which are the comparisons to other manufacturers' lenses that are just as good, but they cost the same amount. This is a different range. I mean, Sigma, what maybe they need to do is split the company, have Sigma Pro and Sigma or something, because of one side of the company, in my opinion, devalues the other side, because they make some really good lenses and they make some real pigs, and they want to basically, even if they call it, don't even call it Sigma, just call it something else. Sigma are going high end, great, and they can have another part of the company that they call Angus, and it can be this sort of thing.
I hope that wasn't a real name of anyone. If there's a company called Angus, then
it's Sigma backwards. I was looking at it on the screen.
Okay. Last story. The BBC has published a story that scientists have produced a 50 gigapixel camera, dubbed the Aware 2. It's a prototype machine, and it looks like the Hadron Collider. It has to be said. It works with synchronizing 98 tiny cameras into a single device. Haven't Panasonic done this just now? Wasn't that the story we started with, the patent?
No,
maybe not. Okay. Developed by a team of engineers called David Brady. Not David Brady. No, he's Bracey, isn't he? The guy that listens to us. And Michael J. Fitzpatrick, Professor of Electronic Engineering at Duke's Pratt School of Engineering and University of Arizona and University of California. What are you going to take? Has it got macro setting or not? I reckon it'd probably be crap for portraits, won't it?
Yeah, exactly. I'll tell you what, if you stuck that Sigma lens on it, I wouldn't fancy its chances.
That's like, oh, you can put new lenses on.
Yeah,
look exactly. Look how giant this thing is now.
I know.
I'll tell you, you'd have a trouble trying to take that down the nightclub, wouldn't you?
Well, there is no scale on it. That's the only problem with this picture. It does look like it's rather big, but...
Looks like it's in a nightclub and it's on someone's table.
Yeah, but I'm just presuming that the yellow cable that's on it is kind of like Cat 5e or something like that, yeah? And if you look at that on that side, this thing is 1200 by 1200 millimetres. 4 foot by 4 foot by the looks.
Yeah, I'd say so. But here's something to keep in mind, though. Here's something to keep in mind. Think about this. The Lytro camera, which is this, you know, it's like this big now. Mm. But that the prototypes that they built at Stanford to do that same thing were like as big as a room.
Yeah, I saw the pictures of that, yeah. Oh, well. No retail price on this, so it'll be at CES next year.
Yeah, but I mean, in all reality, if you could stick this in, I don't know, the Hubble Space Telescope or something, and you could point this at something long enough, you'd get a hell of a good picture of the universe. You might even be able to print it off one-to-one.
That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I really want...
You didn't get that one, did you?
I really want a 50 gigapixel picture of the universe. Maybe, actually, tell you what would be good is if they changed it for medical photography and they went the other way, inner space. You get a really high-res picture.
Yeah.
Mm-mm-mm. Some ducts and cavities that would get some real good attention.
I tell you what, you wouldn't be able to see all this on your retina display, would you, Chris?
Take a 50 gigapixel and put it in a retina display on a new MacBook Pro.
Yeah.
I am telling you, it is going to change the world of colonoscopy.
I'll tell you what, it'd make your eyes water if they shove this one up to have a look, wouldn't they?
Have I got cancer, doctor? I don't know, but you had tuna 8 months ago. Six things on our list. Assuming one is allowed to take one's camera into a concert, what are your top tools, tricks, and tips for getting some good shots at open-air concerts via Dan on Twitter? Chris, you're the event photographer amongst us, really, so go on, start us off with one.
Well, six things. Ooh. I usually don't have one really awesome bright lens and five huge memory cards. And take a ton of pictures.
Just shoot and shoot and shoot. The spray and pray approach.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Because lighting is constantly changing. Oftentimes now, if you're in a small club where they don't really care, you can just go and stand up in front and take pictures as long as you like. If you're at a bigger club or a big outdoor concert and you've got a photo pass, you've got the first three songs to get your shots and that's it. If you're stuck out in the audience, most of the times you're not even supposed to be using cameras. So if you're real conspicuous about it and using a big long zoom, you could get busted and they'll take your camera away. So it's tricky, but yeah, I mean, you know, when I go into venues and I usually have a photo pass, so I'm up there in front, I got three songs to get as many shots that are, you know, acceptable, if not printable, as possible. So it's definitely spray and pray. I like that.
Alex, thought?
Well, I'd probably get the that new Panasonic sensor to help out with the exposure. Then I'd stick a Sigma 18 to 250 on it so I could zoom in and have a 50 gigabyte camera. But back in the real world, to be honest, the zoom lens is really quite useful, especially if you're in an open air concert, because one of the things you can do to limit, you know, when you've got high light values and low light values because it's getting dark and there's sort of spotlights and various things, one of the ways to get around that is to zoom in quite tight on what you want to photograph. And to be honest, there's nothing worse than a wide angle picture of a stage where what you see is basically black, a few dots of light and a bit of red along the top where they've got their nice light show going. So if you can, you zoom in tight on someone, because to be honest, the atmospherics of a singer, you know, a little bit sweaty, a little bit of movement, a little bit of light, it captures the mood a lot better than the fact that there's some great big circus show going on in front of you. So I would say if you can get away with it and you're not going to get caught, or you're as big as Carl, take a really long zoom lens and actually get in tight on them, because it's going to improve your pictures if you're not fighting with the difference in light values.
My tip I have to say, is to not focus on the band. Because, I mean, that's the tendency when you go to any kind of event, is you want to focus on the act on stage and you want to get really good close-up images and that kind of stuff. If you've got yourself right at the side of the stage, actually what you want is a really good width view. So you'll find that a good wide-angle lens will probably be fairly small that you could use. You can get the, what's it, the 8mm Canon? I think that's only sort of 50 millimeters long, 60 meters long, and get yourself to the point where you can shoot a bit of stage and a bit of crowd and wait till the lights boom on the crowd and then get your picture then. The other thing is focusing on the crowd and just look at crowd reaction with just the thing in the background. One of the iconic images that I think of golf was this one taken at the Ryder Cup when Sam Torrance held the last putt. I can't remember the name of the guy that took this, but instead of going right down there and getting the close-up of the photographer of the golfer with the crowd in the background, he just did it the other way around and got the crowd's reaction to it. And that does more to capture the atmosphere than anything else does. So don't focus on the event. That's my big tip, because it's often a bit of a distraction from the general atmosphere that's going on.
Also helps if there's some pretty girls in the picture.
Yeah, no, I mean, if there's flashes and stuff like that, oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's something, is it?
Questions. Here we go then, fellas. Question one. Hi, fellas. Love the show. Keep it the good work. I've been shooting with my Nikon D5500 and noticed that if I change the ISO to get a brighter shot, the image definitely degrades. But if I change the shutter priority, the image gets lighter but doesn't seem to lose its quality. Surely this shouldn't be the case. What am I losing if I change my shutter priority down to increase the exposure values? Gary Smith, Kent. Anyone fancy that one?
Well, I did look at it and just go, if you change the shutter priority, so basically, you're setting the shutter priority. It depends on what you've set your shutter to.
I'm presuming that he's probably shooting in manual and he's altering aperture value and shutter priority independently.
Yeah, because if you're going to make your shutter go a thousandth of a second, it's going to be a bit dark. If you're going to make it go for 5 seconds, it's going to be very light. I mean, what we really need to know is what the exposure value that you're setting the shutter to is. I mean, what I'd say is happening is if you're setting it to shutter priority and you're saying I want it at a 50th of a second, then all the rest of the second settings are correct. If you're just changing the ISO and leaving it on manual, yeah, you're going to, the ISO will give you a brighter picture, but you will degrade. I mean, the question isn't actually asking anything. What I'd say is you've set it on shutter priority, which is fine, but you really need to look what the other values are, because I can't really give you an answer to a question when...
No, I mean, my thought of that question would be...
I don't understand the question.
No, okay. So, I mean, generally speaking, my thought would be that if you're talking about stills photography, you're throwing light into the camera, and the harder and faster you throw the light into the camera, the more aberrations you get and the more degradation of the capture you get.
Quite right.
So he's saying he's noticed a degradation in the capture, which is the ISO, which you'd expect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But he's now saying, well, hang on, if I keep the ISO high but open the shutter up, I would expect a degradation again in stills photography, but I'm not getting that in video photography. So... And when it says there, what am I losing if I change my shutter priority down to increase exposure? It's kind of like I get the impression that this is, there's nothing, no such thing as a free lunch. So he's saying if I'm doing this, I'm getting great images in terms of exposure. So at 1/30th of a second, I'm getting a bright image that's fantastic, but I must be losing something surely. And my thought was that you might increase rolling shutter effect, because does the shutter priority on the video set, I don't know the answers to this, so I am spitballing here, does the shutter priority on when you're shooting video, does that not alter the frequency, if you like, with which the sensor I'm not saying captures the image, that's wrong, but the frequency with which the sensor responds to the image, like a frames per second?
No? Okay, I didn't realise we were talking video, I've got to be honest.
It's a video question.
Is it?
Yeah, I've been shooting.
It is?
I thought I read that as a video question.
That's why I were completely
confused.
No. If it was
video. Oh, right, okay.
Because he's talking shutter priority.
Yeah, no, he's talking stills. I thought it was video. That's, I read that enough as a video question, I'm sorry.
Well, you're probably right. In video, changing the shutter doesn't necessarily actually change the shutter. It changes the sensitivity of it.
Yeah. I think
I'm sorry, fellas. I've retyped that because I couldn't cut and paste. And I've forgotten to type the word video.
So I am completely right in saying I don't understand.
Yeah, you're right, and I'm wrong because I've read
I don't mean that. I read it and thinking, I don't understand the question. I understand the question.
Oh, I'm sorry, fellas.
But it does prove that I read the questions.
It does.
I was thinking, I haven't got a clue what that means.
No, look, see there, it says video, look. I've been shooting video with my Nikon D5500. See, it's
just appeared.
Thank you.
We missed it.
Is it supposed to be video?
It is now.
It was supposed to be video. The original email said video.
Okay.
Right, I've been shooting video.
So I was just about to call you all stupid.
With my Nikon D5500. Notice that if I change the ISO to get the brightness, we can edit this, don't worry. The image definitely degrades, but if I change the shutter priority, the image gets brighter, but still doesn't seem to lose quality. Mm-hmm. There we go. So what he's saying is,
he cranks the ISO and gets more noise and he doesn't like it.
He cranks the ISO, gets more noise, doesn't like it, but he says that if he cranks the shutter priority, he seems to not get any noise. But he doesn't believe that he's not losing out. That's what I read. No?
Yeah, where he's confused, though, he says surely this shouldn't be the case. But the camera isn't changing the ISO if he changes the shutter.
No.
It's gonna adjust the aperture. And you can use different shutter speeds with video, too, up to a certain limit. So it just sounds like he's keeping the ISO steady and letting in more light, which should give you a higher quality image.
Yeah, my understanding of the shutter priority when shooting with video is that it doesn't actually do the same shutter movement, obviously, as it does. But what it does, it increases the sensitivity with using other means. So it's basically increasing the sensitivity but not changing the ISO. So, yes, it's not like with a camera, which is the actual, you know, opening and closing of the time it's open and closing, allowing light in. But my understanding of shutter priority in video is it just changes the ISO, and I think it can actually up the sensitivity of the sensor artificially.
Oh, I don't think it changes ISO. Granted,
no, it doesn't change ISO, but that's the point. It's the only time you change it without changing the ISO.
Now, the issue is when you're shooting video is you can change the shutter speed, but there's a practical limit when you're... So if you're doing like 30... if you're in Britain, you're doing, 25 frames a second for your video, right?
Mm.
Yeah.
If you're doing 25 frames a second, the fastest shutter speed you can even conceivably have is 1/25th of a second. So you can actually increase that shutter speed some. Typically, the shutter speed will be much faster. It'll just happen every 25 times per second. So every 1/25th of a second, it'll take an exposure, but the shutter speed is actually usually pretty fast.
Okay, so I didn't think it actually opened and closed the shutter. I just thought it kept the...
Well,
it's a nominal change.
Well, it changes the scan rate.
Yeah, like yeah that's sort of... Scan. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, Grant in the chat room is saying, in video, it changes the frame rate. Use of the shutter changes the frame rate, which is what I was thinking. So you'd end up with like a rolling shutter effect because it would be scanning slower. An aspheric rate.
I think what he's really seeing is he's cranking the ISO and getting really noisy images.
Yeah.
And the noisier it gets, it's harder to compress well, so the compression will look crappier, basically.
Yeah. So he's got around it by using shutter priority. So he's turning it down and shooting at 1/30th, 1/15th, etc. of a second. And that doesn't seem to change the quality, because he's still capturing high quality. He's at presumably ISO 100. How come he's not losing something?
All right, I got
it. I think he's losing frame rate.
Yeah, that's the point. If you're losing frame rate, so basically you've got double the exposure time on each frame, then that frame will be brighter and less pixelated, but you'll have less of them. Is that what we're saying?
Where's David Dugdale when you need him?
Yeah, he's probably doing something important.
Yeah.
Like working or something.
Well, by the time I've edited this will only be 10 minutes, don't worry.
That's all right.
Two, hey, fellas. This is from the chat room. Paul in the chat room. He says, hey, fellas, what three things do you always use in Photoshop on every image and why? Chris, I think this is going to be a simple answer.
I would say levels.
Yep.
Unsharp mask.
Check.
I guess image size. Because I'm usually reducing stuff to fit into, you know, a website stands or something. Or I'm doing, you know, use the crop tool to, you know, resample an image to fit a certain print size.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I always use auto tone, auto color, and auto correct.
Don't not really talk crap.
What?
No, what I actually do is it's very similar to what you do
with Missy.
Shoot on the P and you don't have to do that.
Now, what I actually do is because, heaven forfend, I do shooting raw. All the things you just talked about, I basically do, but I do it through the raw conversion. So when I bring it in, I open up the raw, or whatever it's called, camera raw, I suppose. I do my sharpening there. I do my noise reduction in there. I even tell it what size I want to output. So if I don't want the full size image, I actually output it slightly smaller. So I don't even bother sending it through. And so I do my sharpening. And if I need to do any black correction or recovery, I don't tend to need to do fill-in, but it's all in the camera raw, and I can in fact just use the camera raw and save it for 9 times out of 10.
It didn't ask you what you do in the camera, it asked you what you do in Photoshop.
But so in fact, if you use the camera raw, you don't actually ever have to go into camera Photoshop, because you can save directly from camera raw and never actually go into the full Photoshop. But you've got all that functionality, and to be honest, you've got a lot more functionality than if you've actually taken it into Photoshop and played with it afterwards.
My three: levels, sharpening, and healing brush. There you go. Or healing tool.
Spot removal tool when you've got a dirty sensor.
Yeah. I can't clean my lenses in 2 weeks, taking off the dust. But that's it, pretty much. Tidying up edges and that kind of stuff using healing tool.
Yeah.
Question three. I walked out of a bright spring morning and found this outdoor food court in the shade of a very tall building. A few seconds later, a huge plume of smoke arose from one of the stalls, all very atmospheric and everything. The resulting image, though, wasn't very satisfying. So with the forthcoming bash and a pig roast, we'll talk about the bash in a minute, I linked, do you have any tips for photographing scenes with smoke or possibly fogs or mist? I used Snapseed to produce the second image, which is kind of fun, but it would have been better to have done it in the first image. So we've got a picture on the video here of the two images left and right. Original image is on the left, if I have to point that out, but go ahead then, fellas. Capture the original image better?
I think this goes back to something that Alex was saying earlier, but it's your eyes and not even just your eyes, but more it's like your brain is constantly adjusting. When you look around a room, it's adjusting constantly to the light levels in different parts of the room, the dynamic range it's constantly adjusting to. And when we see this stuff, a lot of times it just looks better than we can really capture it. Just by taking I'm gonna say normal exposure, just, you know, picking an exposure and taking it. So when you have smoke and fog in a scene, it actually reduces the dynamic range significantly. And so it looks to me like that's essentially the effect that's happening here. Is the smoke looked cool when he looked at it with his eyes because his brain was compensating for the reduced dynamic range. So then he took a picture of it and got this picture with a reduced dynamic range, and then put it in Snapseed and, you know, bump the contrast and, you know, play with the levels or whatever, and suddenly it looks much cooler. And I think there's really no way around it. That's going to be an issue. I mean, it's, you know, in my darkroom days, I would have pulled out the number 5 Ilford filter and bumped the contrast on a picture like this.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a lack of contrast in there. It's definitely pale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Alex?
Yeah, I mean, that's it. You can put on a high contrast filter if you want, but that's something you have to be prepared for, because a high contrast filter, as well as, you know, it's very good at that, but you'd have to go out just to shoot pictures with smoke, because everything else is going to, you know, it's going to degrade rapidly. But yeah, it's a case of you need to filter for it. Or you put it in Photoshop and you whack up a load of contrast. But you need to also, if you're going to whack up a load of contrast, you also have to whack up, is it the vibrance or the saturation or something, because of not only are you losing contrast, you're also losing levels of color. So you need to up the color saturation and up the contrast. But you can do that when you shoot, but you need to do that with filtration on the lens.
Yeah, I think 10X is who sent the picture in. The first thing I'd say, 10X, is the fact that post-processing, you needed to do something with contrast. I've just run it very quickly through Photoshop, and there is a very subtle change there. If you look at the highlights on the roof there behind, they're up to full spec. Maybe I've actually blown them out a fraction. It's a lot darker in the coat. There's less detail in the coat, but you're looking for the smoke to be the highlight. The other problem that you get with this, though, when you take these kind of images, is that you're metering probably off something that's incorrect. You're trying to capture the smoke, and the smoke is actually reflecting light. So what you need to do is meter off the smoke. And that's really difficult to do because it's always looking through, because it's got some opacity. It's looking through to the darker background that's causing you to see it in the first place. Split metering and shooting in manual will help you a great deal with that. I took... when we did the last photo walk in Camden, Martin Meadows-Evans and I went down, and there was a nice smoke coming or mist coming through off on the water. And he said, how do I take that picture? And I said, well, you meter off the building, you meter off the sunlight, and then you split the metering and you'll probably find that you'll get close with it. And lo and behold, he did. But that shot there, I think you've got that instantly. So I think you'd have struggled to sit and set that up. So
yeah, the only other thing you could do is if you had a tripod and you're actually going for the smoke as opposed to going for the people and everything, if you make the exposure slightly longer, because you get the same effect as you do of leaving water, say, yeah, on moving water. It will appear smokier and it will appear thicker, but just because you've exposed it for longer.
But you leave it too long and it's a white backdrop.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, you've picked a very difficult subject, but I mean, the original shot you took is recoverable, especially if you say shot that in RAW, it's recoverable, because you can process it for the smoke.
Yeah, I mean, point in the chat room here from Paul saying that the focus is the guy on the bench. I don't think it is, actually. He's looking slightly out of focus to me in the original image, but it's a tough one. Anyway, there you go. Meter. It's a better one. Better to do. This podcast and all the others would not be possible without UK2.net. They are superb. They are fantastic, and we need them to keep us going, because we've had a bit of a month, it would seem. The last week's Mac show, there was more downloads of last week's Mac show in 4 days than the entire network did the week before.
Wow.
We've done 92,000 downloads of last week's Mac show, so thank you very much to everyone who's downloaded it. Very, very pleased. Very, very happy. UK2 picks up all the bandwidth. We've already consumed 17 terabytes of data this month, and we've got another
wow
2 weeks to do. So we're kind of really earning their gratitude. Please support them if you want us to stick around. They are the most important thing to us, because that kind of bandwidth charge, I'd need a mortgage to keep up with it. If you've got anything that's web-based, host, you know, that kind of stuff, hosting, domains, VPS, VPN, DNS, all of that kind of stuff, this is what these guys do. They do it so, so well. You can go and set yourself a site up in under 10 minutes, including pages. They've got a fantastic system called Site Builder, which you buy. It's $2.95 a month, and it gives you a web page. And you can set up a web page in under a minute using this software. It's superb. If you do want to buy anything from them, you're going to get fantastic prices. I mean, unheard of prices from using the offer codes that we've got. Go and buy a domain. Now, you type in the offer code British Tech Domains. Don't forget the S, because the domain won't get you anything. And before you put in your payment details, you hit return. That'll change your basket instantly down by 20% for all the domains that you've purchased. 20%. No one does 20%. And then, say you've got a DNS management charge in there because you've transferred your domain in, you type in British Tech DNS and hit return again before your payment details, and that DNS management charge is gone entirely. That's £20 just gone straight away. You could end up with a zero basket here if you're not careful. VPS, VPN, they're all covered there. Just type in British Tech, VPN, VPS, DNS, and so on. All the offer codes are on the website. Click on the UK2 link and it'll take you to the sponsors page, britishtechnetwork.com/sponsor, and they'll sort you out there. Fantastic value for money. Please, please, please support them, because if we had to pick up the bandwidth charge, we just simply wouldn't be here. We couldn't afford it. So We get no revenue or anything like that from them. We just get kudos from them. And if you want to sign in, you must use our link on our website. If you use the offer codes, they'll honour the offer codes. There's no question of that. But we won't get the credit for having sent you unless you go through from our page. So go to BritishTechNetwork.com first and use them. Please support them. Thanks ever so much to them. We really value their sponsorship going forwards.
Yay!
Yeah. The Bash. 2 weeks today. This time, in 2 weeks today, I'll be drunk. And Alex will be hosting the photo show.
Yeah, why not?
Because I'll be under a table somewhere. We've got a pig roast for a start. We've got a tech journalist, a proper one, not just us. Andy Anatko is going to be there. He'll actually be at the Bash. We've got loads and loads of beer. TechSmith has sponsored the event, so all the food and beer is down to TechSmith, so you need a big thank you to them and Betsy Weber. And it should be an absolutely fabulous day. You do need a ticket. You can't come without your ticket. You've got to go to britishtechbash.eventbrite.co.uk and buy yourself a ticket. It's 20 quid and everything's covered. Once you get here. And there's mead. There's 18 pints of mead to be shared amongst us. So taste sessions all round. But there'll be tons of stuff here. There'll be loads of food. There'll be loads going on. And we've got a band coming in the form of James Hart and his mate Simon. And they're going to give us some entertainment as well. And we'll have a little impromptu band and karaoke-esque session, I'm sure. And have some fun during the day. And all the podcasts that we've got on the network are going to be done that day. So we'll start with the photo show probably 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock-ish, and then we'll just sit and podcast for the whole day and make up the shows as we go along. I've been talking to Carl. There might be a very special edition of Worlds Apart. We need to figure that one out, but it should be fun. Last word, where can we get a hold of you, Mr. Forsman?
You can get a hold of me at rstechnica.com, as usual, or if you want to be a little more personal about it, I'm on the Twitters at Forsmac.
Or lying naked, rubbing a Retina MacBook Display Pro thing all over your body.
Yeah.
You are in love with that machine.
I'm going to go do it right now.
Are you going to... Good lad. Can you just wait till after the Mac show? we're going to... presumably, is this one you've got to return or are you going to get to keep it?
I've got to return it, yeah.
Look, if you've let everyone know that you've been rubbing it on you, I don't want to want it back anyway, so you'll be all right.
Yeah, we'll tell Apple that's the case. And Mr. Fox, where are you?
I'm Alex G. Fox on Twitter. And thank you, all these lovely people that have started to follow me lately. I'm not sure why, but I'm really grateful that you are.
Oh, isn't that sweet?
Yeah, it's very nice.
We'll be back again next week with all the photo news and your questions. If you've got a question, send it to us at britishtechnetwork@gmail.com and we'll mistype it so that it's a completely different question. There we go. See you next week. Thanks for watching.
Bye.
Bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting.